Right, and Jana, very exciting to see you again. I'm so happy we're meeting again.
Totally, Mahana. Lovely to see you too.
How have you been?
I have been great. It looks sunnier now, so it's always a good thing. How about
That's
you?
awesome. Yeah, really good, really good. It's been a while since we talked the last time. So it's been probably, what, 2 months or something like that since we did our first recording of the podcast. Which I really thank you about. You've been really very generous with your time and helping me on getting this thing launched. So really appreciate it.
No, that was so much fun. I think I also know not much about podcasts, so it was very interesting and educational for me too. So I really thank you for like inviting me over and having this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And really glad because I think just having this interview with you and having this chat, I think a lot of our viewers and listeners will learn a lot. So there's a lot of things that you bring to the table. Of course, you've from either your life, your where you've lived before, or what you're studying, or definitely with your work. So, and I think there's a lot of things that just by talking about our listeners will find very entertaining, amusing, and useful, which is what is really important.
Sounds awesome. I'm actually really curious to know a bit more about this podcast and your journey so far with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the first thing, I mean, there's a lot of updates. The first thing is, you remember probably the podcast name was Double Click. I had to change Double Click, so now it's not called Double Click. It's kind of like a podcast. There's a really funny story because I was trying to register the podcast and I went and looked online and there was another podcast that is called Double Click. Which was completely not what I was trying to do. And that is probably the problem with picking any name. So a lot of the times, if it was for a business or if it was for a YouTube channel on Instagram, everybody's doing it now. And so picking a name is really difficult, even when you find the name that you want. So I had to go and spent another 3 or 4 weeks just thinking about a name, brainstorming, asking people, getting feedback. Did a lot of things, and I was talking with my friend finally, and I'm trying to find a name that can be translated to Arabic, but also like it at least has some meaning in Arabic because the podcast is directed towards the Arabic viewers and listeners mostly, and the Arab-speaking viewers and listeners. And then I was telling my friend, I kind of like figuratively speaking. So I'm telling him I want to call the podcast Figuratively Speaking because that's a part of a famous Arabic poem, which is translates to Majaz and Aqul. So there is a really cool poem called Majaz and Aqul, but it's a cool name. And my friend thought I was telling him kinda like is the name of the podcast, and he was, oh, I like kinda like. I don't no, it's Figuratively Speaking.
So funny.
And he says, "Oh, but I like kinda like more." And I tell him, "You know what? I'm hearing it, and I like the name too." Went and looked online, and there is actually another podcast called Kinda Sorta Like a Podcast, and I don't know what they do, but I thought, you know what? I'm just gonna do that. So went really quickly and booked the name and had my first episode recorded. So there you go. It's now Kinda Like Podcast.
That's such an interesting story. Named completely by accident. I love it. And I think it's a nice name. I didn't know there was a poem called Figuratively Speaking. Very mysterious.
Yeah. Do you know who Mahmoud Darwish is? Have you heard of Mahmoud Darwish?
No.
So Mahmoud Darwish is a Palestinian-American, I think Palestinian-American, Palestinian-Israeli poet, and he's one of the he's one of the top poets in the Arab world. He writes in a very unique way, so his style is what we call free poetry. He doesn't really commit to the rhyme. It has some rules, but it's not like the traditional Arabic poetry. And he's one of my favorite poets, Mahmoud Darwish. He has a lot of his poetry actually translated into English, and a lot of things around themes like love and occupation and freedom and all of these things. So I'll probably send you a couple of his poems to have a look at.
That would be nice. Do you like the translations? I often find that when there are like Indian epics translated to English, I read the English version and I think, surely that's not what they meant. but do you find the translations kind of good?
I mean, yeah, as long as they don't do it with Google without any, you know, if they directly translate it, then it's not good. It doesn't capture the whole story. And that's part of the whole translation thing. So many times you just go with what you have. It get as close as it gets. But yeah, some of his translations actually I found are really good. Do you know Pink Floyd?
You know what? Thanks to you, I know they exist.
So Pink Floyd, definitely one of my favorite bands, and their guitar bassist at some point, Roger Waters. Roger Waters is really active and just, you know, he's an activist, so a lot of social issues and freedom issues. And he translated and sang one of his songs, which was really, really good. Like when you listen to it, I'll probably even link it to this episode of the podcast for people to hear it. And he's one of the people who tries to promote Mahmoud Darwish's poetry. So I'll definitely send it to you.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool.
What an exciting start to the podcast.
Yeah.
Love it.
Very much. But that's the best thing about it, right? So podcasts, as you know, I mean, a lot of them are scripted, they do appeal to certain type of people, but the form that I'm trying to get into and the form that I'm trying to promote is called the long form. And this long form is around, you know, talking in the podcast, having a chat with someone, sort of not very, very structured, keep it flowing, and then see where you go in that conversation. And I'm hoping through that way, through conversation with interesting guests and people who have something for us all to learn from. Maybe we can get some lessons. Maybe we can get some points to learn from, some aha moments. It's a little bit similar to coaching. So remember when we used to coach, you go in and you don't know what's the what you're doing in the coaching session, and just trying to go with the flow and see what you'll get, and just, you know, ask a question here or find a truly interesting point here and talk about it, see where you get. Unlike coaching, you know, in this session I feel like I'm talking a lot and not letting the people know about you.
I think this is great. You know, in fact, you took me to a coaching land for a small bit there, and I was thinking about how you sometimes get this aha moment with your coachee. And then you need to make sure you're still there for them. You're holding space for them. But you just got an aha moment. You have to park it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, fully turn back to them. But it is such a generative process, coaching. And I think this probably is too. How have you felt so far with your podcast so far?
It's been really good. I mean, I haven't, there are some... It's really fun and interesting and something that I want to do. It's you know, think of it as a passion project, so not something that I'm doing as a business. But I feel like there's a lot of audience for it out there. I have also my reasons. Like, part of my reasons is that I want people to make use of the information that we have here, make use of this content. A lot of the content, especially on the Arabic side of the internet, like we have a lot of fun things, we have a lot of entertaining things. We have some useful content, but we still can do much more in that area. So I'm hoping, you know, by taking this chance, I'm learning, and then I'm helping other people who would be interested in these topics to learn more from conversations. So it's been good, and there are challenges also. So definitely, because I'm not doing it as a business and not doing it for profit, and the people who I'm trying to work with, you know, sometimes calendaring is a difficult thing. Many of the guests that I'm trying to get on the podcast are not based here in the US. So, you know, for us, it's really easy. There's a 2 hours difference between where we live. But sometimes when I'm trying to talk with someone in Dubai or someone in Iraq, there's 11 hours difference. So you know, there are these challenges, and then trying to get into everything. So from finding a platform, from doing this conversation online, because ideally we would have this conversation, me and you, in the same room and having the podcasting and kit and the camera and everything, which would, I think, make it closer to a real conversation. But when we don't have all of that and we have the internet to the remote podcast, then, you know, I feel like this could be a challenge, but it's a challenge for now. So trying to go with it, get my first maybe 5-6 episodes out there and see after that where it goes.
Yeah, and also I think now slowly we're getting used to this, no? I mean, nowadays, I don't know if this continues. At some point, I'll be more comfortable speaking to people on a screen than in person. You know, so maybe it's not that bad at all. But I, at the same time, understand and miss speaking to people in person. It is, you know, seeing faces without masks in person, especially. So,
yeah,
totally feel you.
Definitely such an interesting times, like with the pandemic and everything, from going into times of not talking to anyone, and then all of a sudden talking to everyone online and through virtual platforms. So definitely interesting times. So yeah, how about I introduce you formally now? And I know that we've got some good conversation going, but let's introduce you formally, and then from there pick the conversation and see where we go. So Anjana Lakshmi, a computer science engineer, occupational psychologist, and consultant, born in India, lived in Dubai, and now you're living in Chicago, a single mom, and currently doing your PhD full-time in social psychology. So a lot of interesting things. I think we could pick at any one of these and then go deeper into the conversation. But anything that I didn't mention or you'd like to mention?
I think you got it all. I also I'm a dog mom too, so I have.
Oh, you have a dog
too. I had two dogs. Now I have one. My dog is in Dubai, but absolute dog lovers, both me and my son. But otherwise, awesome. I think you've got it all sorted.
Cool. What type of dogs do you have?
So the one that passed away was a beagle, and then I have a dachshund who's still around.
What's the name of it?
Obi-Wan Kenobi. That's the guy who's in Dubai. His name is Obi-Wan Kenobi. We call him Obi-Wan, and Bailey is the name of my beagle.
Oh, cool. So you're a Star Wars fan too.
You know what? Actually, it was my ex-husband. So he called first dibs on the dog's name. He was like, no. Listen, we'll have a dog. His name will be Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I was like, you know? But now, after naming your dog Obi-Wan, you have to watch Star Wars. So I did end up watching and liking it. Sure.
So have you watched how many episodes? Like, there are 12 episodes of them out there?
I have no idea how many I've watched. And I've watched some movies too, but don't ask me which of them I watched. But I can kind of tell you who the characters are, and I can kind of say, you know, how Yoda speaks, for example. Things like that, for sure.
That's cool. I don't know. Although I've been a fan of movies, and I have, you know, my own movies that I really enjoy watching over and over, but Star Wars never warmed up to it. It's definitely has its big following, and there's, you know, especially here in the US, I feel like more than outside. My friend was explaining it to me, and he said once you watch the first and second movies, there is some really deeper message into it. Like once you get it, it's something that is very, very profound. It's not only about the I don't know. Maybe I should host one of.
Maybe we should revisit it. I don't know either. Maybe we should revisit it. I don't know. Like, I feel like that about Harry Potter. I know I sound like a child when I say this, but I feel like there's so much there for me. Every time I read, there's more meaning that comes out. Yeah. So, I guess there's some sort of stuff in these things.
Yeah. So you've read Harry Potter. You like the movies, and oh, that's cool.
Oh, I absolutely love Harry Potter. There was a time the final book, when it came, was the first time I could afford to buy my own book because an adult then. Mm-hmm. I pre-booked because I was like, oh my God, I can actually buy a Harry Potter book. So it's very, very special. And for sure, I watched the movies like 10 million times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing that I've never... Like, I watched one movie, but I've never got into the whole Harry Potter thing also. Again, maybe I should revisit it. But also, like, I think if I get guests here who really have a thing about it, maybe it's something that we could talk about even in one of our episodes in the podcast on what does it mean and what are the lessons in Harry Potter. Because there's a lot of... I mean, definitely when Harry Potter was written, or when similar things are written, they do come from somewhere, from probably a personal experience in real life, and they do give people something that they can sort of live in the real life. I know I feel that about Pink Floyd, probably about their lyrics and about their songs, and it does come. Like when you get very fond of something and like it that much, it does have something that you can either see it applied, or you can see that it has stronger meaning than just entertainment.
Absolutely. And I think as long as it can provide more and more depth, it's an art, right? Mm-hmm. That's what art is. Can it take you to different depths each time? Can you draw something from it that adds meaning, right? And Harry Potter definitely did that for me for a long time. It's been a while, but I still am, you know, I have a lot of appreciation for that set of books.
Awesome. That's really cool. So maybe we can go back to it at some other time, but let's see now. So from the different things and jobs and degrees that you've done, Anjana, maybe... Run us really quickly on how did you start with computer science and engineering, and then move to studying psychology, and then now doing your PhD in social psychology. How about that?
Sure. So I come from a family of engineers. So my grandfather was an engineer, my father was an engineer, my uncles are engineers, my sister is an engineer, and I was an engineer. So we all like... that was what we kind of knew as a route of going from education to occupation. Uh-huh. And so it was almost a natural transition. I was too young to decide anyway. So, I was thinking of things like psychology and architecture around that time. I thought there was something called ethnography that looked interesting, ethnology. And I wasn't sure, though. There was so much out there that was not very... widely studied in India, like mm-hmm. anthropology, and they all looked interesting, but I really couldn't like reach out to them. But computer science was something that I knew how to do. I knew how to get to, so I did become a computer science engineer. I worked in the industry for a while. I programmed, mm-hmm. Loved what I did, actually, in many ways. You know, when you have a process that runs for 4 hours and you can change it to something that runs for 3 minutes, and there is a huge sort of feeling of you solved a big problem for your client. So it was a great time working over there. But I think throughout, I was interested in studying people a bit more. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what it's called. And that is, you know, the funny thing in all of this. When I was really tiny, my grandfather was a huge influence in my life. And we'd both go on walks. And in the walk, he talked to me about British rule. He talked to me about... you know, politics in India. Mm. He was very pro-British rule, actually, which is interesting. My father was a Gandhian, and my grandfather was very pro-British rule. So it was very interesting to have these conversations, and I thought, this is so interesting. This is so fun and exciting. And so that's the kind of thinking I wanted to do more of in my life, but I just didn't know what that is. Mm. But in the meanwhile, I started my career in computer science. I was doing okay. And then my son was born at some point, and I did take some time off to kind of focus on my parenting. My son needed me, so I was like home taking care of him for a while, and I thought, why shouldn't I like look at what this thing was that I always wanted to do? Like, why don't I look up what are my options? Who studies these things across the world? And that's how I encountered social psychology. And the more I read about it, I thought, oh my, this is what I always wanted to do. And it's got a name. There are courses that take care of it. This is something I really want to do. And so I emailed, I tried to find people I'd like to work with. And I emailed some professors who I thought were doing amazing work, interesting work. And one of the professors I reached out to said, hey, you know, there is this study. If mm-hmm. you want to collect data for it, you should, you know, join us. And I did. And she's still my advisor. She's one of my advisors. So it's a journey that started in 2010, really, and has landed here, you know, with like with a feeling of dreams coming true. But it was a long scenic route. So I started doing independent research assistance from India first, and then I moved to Dubai. Then I continued doing that for a while. And then it felt like, obviously, this is something I really want to do with my life. I should, and my son needed me less and less too. He was going to school. So I was like, this is a good time for me to step back in and make it a bit serious. And so, you know, I checked out schools in Dubai that would take care of social psychology for me. I couldn't mm-hmm. find anything. There were like the NYU had an undergraduate course that dealt with social psychology, but there were no postgraduate courses at that time. The only possibility for me to do a postgraduate in psychology at that time was either applied psych or organizational psychology. So I decided to take up organizational psychology at Harriet Watt University, Dubai, a place I'm super proud of and happy with. I made some really good mentoring relationships there, but also friends. And so I studied there and I worked in consulting for some time. That's when I met you,
yeah.
Right? And I got inspired by what it is that you do. I remember I was a lab rat and you were there doing your thing. And I was like, oh my God, I could do this. You know, this looks great. And it's actually a helpful sort of job in many ways.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a while. That helped me pay all my master's degree bills. So I paid all my loans back. I was doing really well. And then at some point came the decision of maybe, you know, it is time for us to kind of think about doing this thing that we always wanted to. Around the same time I got divorced, not to get to too much detail of that, but, you know.
we could have an episode for that.
I don't know about that. But, you know, it all came together in a way. And it turned out I could pursue my dream of studying social psychology elsewhere. And that's how I started applying again. And here I am. Studying social psychology like I wanted, knowing what it's called for a change. So it's been a brilliant, very adventurous journey, but it's been so, so fulfilling.
Amazing. So how does it feel now to go back to what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that you've had that dream and at some point it wasn't very clear how you're going to act on it. And now you're again doing that. Like, does it make it easier to study the field that you really want? So compared to when you probably felt a little pressured, I don't know if it was actually pressure that got you into engineering the first time.
That's a good question. I think it would be easy for me to say pressure, but did I have a very strong opinion mm-hmm. of what I wanted to do? No. So I have a feeling back at home, the idea is how can you provide stability for your children? And the way you provide stability for your children is to teach them what you do as your vocation. Mm-hmm. And maybe that'll help them have a home and pay their bills. So I think if I was very strong about becoming something else, there might have been a way for me to push it. But my parents supported me the best way they could by saying, here, this is what you're going to do. And I was like, okay. So I won't call it pressure, so to speak. But I do think, you know, we didn't explore as much as we could. But again, I don't know to what extent that would have been possible for anyone in my generation back in my home country, right? So so I don't call it pressure, but you could tell the difference. When my mm-hmm. friends from engineering college, they talk to me, they're like, you study? Like, what? you're not at all studious. That's not you. What are you doing in school still? So I think it shows because the degree of seriousness I have, the degree of love I have for just studying more and more and learning more and more about this is just humongous compared to the kind of person I was back in engineering. So I do think passion makes a difference. And I do think it makes a difference if it's hard to get something. Then you enjoy it a lot more. You kind of really fight to keep it. I at least from my end, I felt that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it definitely, like, I mean, you hear a lot about parents, especially in the Middle Eastern families and probably Eastern and Asian families, a lot about you study the field that is, you know, will make you successful, and then you go and think about then what you want to have your passion, and it seems like it worked. All of them together has worked for you so far.
Yeah, I also feel that a lot of it is exposure. The one thing I know, for example, that my son has is he will know people who do a variety of professions, right? Back in India, it used to be mostly you knew engineers or doctors, maybe people who worked in finance and law. And so you don't know their social psychology because there's no one doing it. So I think to a great extent, it's also a matter of exposure. Your parents can only teach you the ropes for something they know. If someone in the family did something, maybe they'll know something about it, but it needs more and more exposure to different fields and to know that you can find stability in a field that's not very mainstream.
Okay, sounds great. And Jana, what? So it's interesting that you're saying that you're not very studious. You haven't been. You don't see yourself as a student continuously, or.
Oh, that's such a deep question.
Because I also
like
want to know.
Coaching session. No, that's a good question.
But it's also really something very interesting I'm interested about, because let's say if you're not known as the really student type, right? So you're not going to always make it to the medicine school, or you're not someone whose degrees are always, how can you still do something and succeed in it without being a grade A student? Like, I think that is something that you're doing now. And I don't know if you're, because I still thought that you were a grade A student.
I am a grade A student, but in this field. So back in computer science, I remember at the end of every exam, I would tell my dad, "Dad, I'm not going to make it this time." Mm-hmm. And he would be like, "So what lessons have you learned for next time?" And I'd be like, "I'm going to work hard, Dad." I would never do that. So I think my grades were really down as long as I was not doing, I mean, I still did okay, but it wasn't top notch. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely not, my heart and soul were not in it. So I did finish my engineering with distinction, but I remember the person next to me was like, "You are sitting in the same row as me. I actually worked hard for this." So I think we all will find our, you know, it's easier to get a good grade in something you love.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem in a lot of our educational systems, especially in education systems that are more like narrow there are only so many paths, is that if you're like not so good at A, you start thinking maybe you're not so good at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge misconception, because if you're not good at A, that is point one, it just means you're not yet good at A. The point, that is what Carol Dweck would say. She's a psychologist who talks about something called the growth mindset. And she says, you know, we can kind of, it's like a muscle. You can grow your intelligence in an area or skills in an area. But at the same time, I might be overstating this, in which case, I'm sorry, Dr. Dweck. But at the same time, you know, I do think that we might find strength in some areas and not in others. And we need to be able to kind of see that to be able to succeed.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. You were quoting from talking about growth mindset, the concept and the book, right?
Yes.
Do you know, I forgot the writer's name.
Carol Dweck. I read about her book way before I became, I joined my course, and I thought it was a very interesting concept and also very freeing concept to think that, you know, you could stop saying "I don't know" and then say, "Actually, I just don't know yet, and I can work towards that goal," frees you up quite a bit. So I cannot say that I have consumed that research, you know, critically enough to fully evaluate it, but I liked the idea of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, hey, I mean, how cool is it for me to think that I can do something and that I'm not limited in any way? So I like that way of thinking. And I think to just kind of be able to think that for yourself and your kids and in general about the world is like a nice way to go about things.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've read that book and I really liked it. And it is true, like as I was reading it, I was feeling much more inspired because the book does let you, let you think that you're not bound by things. So definitely not by the way, not by things that we know are probably more static. So the intelligence or your IQ. Again, I don't know, and that's probably what you're saying too, is it's probably something that is still needs a lot of validation and research to know that intelligence or IQ is something that can change, especially with time, because you know there's a lot of research that says that we reach to a certain level of intelligence and then that is where we are. But the important, I think, lesson here is that normally you are not bound only by your intelligence. So and for most probably jobs, for most occupations or business that you want to do, you don't need to be the smartest. You don't need to have really high IQ. And then there are other attributes that you can use and you know, your strengths. So there is your ability to build relationship with people, how you can plan, how you can think in the longer term, which are most of them are not only about your IQ. So you don't have to be always the grade A student to be successful.
I totally agree. Actually, it may be that the research is actually very well founded by now. I've just not stayed on top of it after I first encountered it. But also what I like is not just the idea of our intelligence may expand, but for us to stop thinking that our intelligence is fixed. I think sometimes it's not even that we reach the top of our intelligence. It's like,
yeah,
we start thinking we reached it. We like kind of can drag ourselves down really well as a species. We seems to be great at it, at least from my example of myself. And so I like the idea of pushing yourself and saying no. Like you could actually push if you wanted. You could do well in anything.
Yeah.
You know, as a quick example, I did my 11th grade in a new city in a new state, and so there was a big shift in educational systems and. I remember in my math exam, I think I got like a 20 out of 200. I was pretty bad.
That was really bad.
Yeah. So I remember going to my math teacher then, and she was like, well, you know, it's not a problem for you. You don't need to bring bread to the home one day. That guy you see there, like, he needs to do well. And I took that very personally.
Wow.
And, you know, but at the end of my 12th grade, I got a 198 out of 200 because I think sometimes you kind of have to break that barrier of this is how much I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of have to really push yourself to see how far you can go. Having said that, that does not, like you said, I don't think that's the only skill that matters either. Like you could know all your math, but if you go into music, it may or may not benefit you at all, right? You might have other skills that you can bring into it. You know, and I think there are a lot of those skills that I see applied nowadays and here more than I have seen applied in community in my past and where I came from.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe let me ask you a little bit about the different studies that you've done. So like particularly I'm interested, and I think our viewers and listeners might be also interested in that, the difference between the organizational or did you study organizational or occupational psychology?
Occupational psychology.
Okay. But So maybe what is that field? What does it do? And then what got you, I think you said you got drawn into it because you were interested in social psychology and that was the closest thing to it. And then what is social psychology?
So occupational psychology actually ended up meeting some of my needs to understand or get closer to social psychology in a way, because there are things like leadership, for example, which are at the intersection of occupational and social psychology in many ways. You know, consumer psychology in many ways can be connected to some social psychological work as well. So an organizational change, huge area of talking about it. But I think to kind of, you know, expand on that, I can talk to you about what social psychology is, at least the way I approach it. So it's a huge and beautiful field. It's also a very brave and new field, relatively, in psychology's history, maybe, at least as far as I know. And what it is to me is that, okay, so psychology itself is an idea of, is a study of why we do. I mean, maybe firstly, what are some things we all do systematically, right? Mm-hmm. And across the board. And then why do we do these things? What's happening in our minds that we do these things, right? But then most often, we're not sitting in a little box and thinking on our own. We're people. We talk to people. We interact with people. We think about people. We're hugely social. And I think if anything, the pandemic has brought this out up and center, right? Like, so who do you remove your mask for when you talk to them? You know, in front of whom will you wear a mask versus without? Or are you happy being just in your home? Don't you miss meeting people? So I think because we're social, our mind, you know, kind of has to often work in context of other people, in context of society. And for me, that's where social psychology comes. It's like studying the human mind, but in context of the situations that we are in, of the people we are with, the groups we are in, or, you know, the overall social context we are in, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. So, and that is how I approach social psychology and see it. And I also, and that's why I see a lot of that in things like organizational change and consumer psychology, because it is about people in many ways and how we interact with other people, systems, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have, it's not about sort of the historical element of people and groups, because that would be, is that anthropology?
So I think anthropology, and that way if you look at it like sociology, anthropology, sociology, social psychology, they all might have a lot of elements that they can share and draw from each other. But social psychology, I think, at least to me, is about studying the human mind in context of all these things. Mm. So it is people with people, but what's happening in our minds when we do these things? Exactly why do we do what we do is where the focus primarily is in what I do.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And how long have you been doing your PhD in it? I mean, also, why did you choose to do a PhD?
That's such a good question. So this is my fifth year. I better now know why I chose to do this. But I think this was point one. There are two reasons, to be very honest with you. One is this is what I always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. This was one way for me to study this and talk about this and think about this day in and day out and maybe get paid for it. So, you know, in many ways, it's a fulfilling of what I enjoy most and what I feel comfortable talking about and asking questions about or I'm curious about, and make a living out of it. So that was the main reason. But another reason, the more practical reason, was at some point I was settled into a life of consulting and so on, but I always wanted to do research, and because something that I love doing is asking questions, gathering data, being, you know, supported by evidence, you know, all the things that are actually a bit quirky, like being tentative because you're not really sure, because you can't always be sure. You know, those things are I felt that, you know, were some things that I needed to have in my life to some extent, that feeling of not knowing enough, that feeling of trying to know more. But research jobs were very hard to get without doing your PhD. So I think the two roads met. One is something I always wanted to do, and one is something I ended up doing, but I wished I could kind of extend from there to what I always wanted to do. So I think both for practical reasons and for extraordinarily idealistic reasons, I wanted to do this, and I'm super grateful. I'm very happy with what I do.
That's awesome. That's really, I mean, first, it seems like a lot of people, at least my friends, everyone is doing a PhD now. So I'm always very interested in why they are choosing to do a PhD. And the second thing is, you know, what are they going to get from doing a PhD? Because definitely for 5 years. That's 5 years of studying and spending time, and maybe at times you're not working at the main things that you want to do. And there's always the element of you're doing the PhD, which is, you know, a task. It's not everyone can do it, but it seems like it's easier than what people think. It's not that very challenging thing that you do. So like, could you tell us a little bit about when you were thinking about doing your PhD? Was that like an obstacle for you? Were you thinking about, am I actually going to succeed in it? Am I going to do the long term? Because that's the other thing about it, right? You have to have enough stamina to do the longer term thing, 5 years or 6 years. It's not an easy thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I'd thought that much. To be very honest, I was super excited. I still am. And it's something that, and that's what's amazing. Something like, if you had asked me to do a PhD in computer science, I would have been like, I don't know. I don't know, Mahanat, what are you talking about? I just want to leave. But I think it depends on the fields. I think you're totally right. I don't think it's easy, but I don't think it's difficult either. Mm. I think it's about, it is taxing. Mm-hmm. It is intense. And you, I mean, it is, you know, every day how much you don't know. And you realize that, you know, when you talk, all sorts of, you know, incorrections come out. And yeah, you've got to kind of be used to the fact that sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes you're probably not as rational as you thought. So the fact that we as humans are hugely flawed is upright and center in front of my face all the time. So in a way, I think it's intense, but at the same time, I think it's doable. And I do think it's a huge commitment. It is longer than some marriages. Right, it is.
That's a funny way of thinking about it. I mean, don't scare me. I'm about to.
No. It is much shorter than many. but you know, I do think if you love it, it will feel engaging and fun every day. I wake up to wanting to do more of this.
So. Mm. That's awesome. Like when you were starting, and I know that you were excited about it, you didn't think twice. But do universities or supervisors have something to say, like, here's a prerequisite list of everything that you should have before doing your PhD? Like, again, do you have to, in addition to having the passion and willingness, what does a PhD candidate student need to have to make sure that they will succeed at the end?
That's a really good question. And I feel like I can only give you half the answer because I have never selected someone to be a PhD student. Mm-hmm. I've only gone through that whole application process as a student. So the only thing I can tell you about what I did to kind of prepare for it, whether that's something that works or not, is something I actually have very little idea about. Mm-hmm. But I do think what helped me was to kind of know what it is that I wanted to study, to some extent at least, and to know what skills I might need as a PhD student. So firstly, to decide who it is that I want to work with. So that's a very important decision in your PhD, because you usually work with an advisor or, mm-hmm, you know, a group of advisors. So you need to kind of have an idea what you want to study, because again, it's really intense. You can't study broad in a PhD. You go deep to an extent. So to kind of know where, what excites you, what are you ready to do for the next 5 or 6 or 7 years, you know, is a big question, I think.
Yeah.
But then also to know what skills can you take into the table, not just for your research team, but also for yourself as a graduate student to feel like I can do this, is a big thing. So I think getting some independent research experience is really great. There are universities in the Middle East, in India, in the US, Canada, all over the place that would very happily, you know, offer you to come in and do some research assistantships. I did a bunch back when I was in Dubai. I did RA-ships at Harriet Watt. I did it at University of Sharjah, New York University, Abu Dhabi. So there are opportunities where you can go, you can shadow and put in some, you know, work, sometimes voluntary, to just learn these skills, to learn the language, to learn the skills.
Did you do these as a research assistant as a job, or was it, did you say internships?
So in the beginning, I did it for free, uh-huh, which is voluntary work, which I was like, let me just sit in your lab meetings. Just let me just understand what you all talk about and let me do some work for you. I did that for quite a bit. I think there was one paid RA-ship position I occupied in all of this. Otherwise, it was mostly, I think there were two. I think at Heriot Watt as well, I was a demonstrator. At that time, I was getting paid. And then at University of Sharjah, I got paid. New York University, I fully volunteered. But these were different experiences. And across the board, I think the idea was to get this sort of research experience, to know what research looks like, to be able to speak about it like everyone else spoke about it.
That's very helpful to think about. Like, you could prepare for doing a PhD and then, you know, just to probably to some extent do the research probably without having to do the PhD, because what if someone like me who doesn't want to get in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years? And again, I mean, some PhD degrees doesn't take that long. So some of them would take, I think it's in the US, it's longer than other places in the world. It's known for that. So
yeah, I think it's, I'm not fully sure of this, but as far as I understood, in the UK, you could do your master's and then your PhD is 3 years. Yeah. In the US, a PhD is, master's comes in the second year and then you do your PhD. So though I had a master's already, I did my full 5 years again. I'm doing them. So I got my second master's. So in the process, but that's because it's built in. You know, it doesn't count separately. But you have shorter PhDs, yeah, for sure.
But what if someone like me who doesn't want to even do the 3 years or 2 years PhD, but I'm still interested in research. So I'm interested in probably studying and researching and even publishing something related to, you know, something that I see as scientific, not only my opinions, but something that I do some research for. And then in areas that I'm interested in, is there a way that people do that?
Yeah, I think the main thing that like strikes me immediately as something you might need is an ethics review board that can, you know, kind of oversee your entire project and make sure you're doing ethical research. That's the first thing that comes in. And usually, at least to the extent that I know it, that needs you to be working with someone. Usually all the ethical review board proposals I've had have needed the principal investigator to be a faculty member of the university, some sort of affiliation. So you would probably, I've written a paper, my first paper ever. I didn't write the paper. I was one of the 34 co-authors of the paper.
Wow.
Yeah, it was my first ever endeavor. It was very nice because I just wanted to assist. And the person who led the paper was like, you know what? I think you've done enough work to be a co-author. It was magical. But one of my first two mentors, actually. So that time I was not affiliated to any university. So everyone has an affiliation and mine just says Dubai, I think, or something like that. So I think it's possible if you approach a person who's doing this research and has the ability to get you into their review board and is ready to work with you, they could make sure that the ethical requirements are met. You may need to do like a certificate to kind of make sure that you also are trained to work with human subjects. That is one thing I can think of. And the second thing is the other advantage of working with someone who's already affiliated is you also, it's like almost like knowing the latest technology. So in many ways, you know, what are the latest ways to conduct a research study? You get a lot of resources there. How to collect data, how to analyze data. There's always new things happening in stats. So that comes through. But also, at least in psychology, there's a major movement towards doing transparent research now, making sure you are saying in advance what it is that you're going to do, and then you only do that, you know, so that you don't either advertently or inadvertently do something that is not fully scientific. So there are a lot of these things happening, so you can kind of benefit from all of that knowledge and know-how if you work with someone who's already affiliated. And I have seen people who are not necessarily pursuing their graduate study or PhD working with faculty members out of interest, and I think that's something you can totally do.
Okay.
And at the end of it, you'll be like, you know what? I love it. I'm going to do my PhD. And then we'll talk again, Mahanad. We'll talk again.
I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like at some point in my life, I was thinking maybe let me work a little bit. And then when I'm around 40 or something like that, I'll do my PhD. And then I don't know, the older that I am, the more I'm thinking I want to just work and I want to get more money. So I don't know if I will get, but I am actually really very interested in, you know, either research work, doing studies and publishing. Like there are a couple of topics that I want to research myself. I don't know if there is, there are some research about them, you know, things related to our work again, related to creativity, things related to probably the diversity and inclusion. I know this is a field that is getting much more and more, it is a needed field and it is now when it's really blooming. But I also feel like it's the focus on the diversity and inclusion, depending on where, which context you're talking in. So here in the US, it's very US centric and very in a certain way. I'm more interested, for example, on the cross-cultural diversity and inclusion and what that means, and especially from the Arab side world. There's a lot more that can be done there. So hopefully I can get to do that. Well, if it's a PhD, then it is a PhD, but I can do that without having to go that route.
I think once you get to that tunnel, you'll keep digging, Mahanat, so you might as well get a PhD out of it.
True.
No, but I think there's so much value there, and I think a lot of people here are beginning to ask those questions very seriously now. Like, mm-hmm. They call it non-weird research. Which is basically saying non-Western. It's an acronym. Don't ask me the full, the full form of it. But the idea is places outside the West, places in like in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa, in other areas of the world, which is kind of underrepresented or at least underrepresented in most of psychological research. So I think there is huge value in kind of understanding point one. What happens in other places? Is this a study of all human beings or is this a study of this set of human beings, right? But also the question of, are we asking the questions the right way for a different culture? That's also, interesting, because you can't take a paradigm in the US. I mean, sometimes you can, but sometimes you can't. Take a paradigm in the US and then directly apply it in India or Dubai and think that it's doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that we're coming to terms with is that we firstly do need to study everyone, and then we also need to study how to study people other than the people here. So I think there's a absolute, interest in it. There are people who are focused on that, and I think you will be an asset to someone who wants to study that kind of stuff, because a lot of it is also, how can you ask the right questions if you haven't, had some intuitions going around it, some conversations around it. So I think it's really beneficial for people to step in and say, I want to study more of my culture too. So one of my primary mentors in the beginning, the person who let me be in her paper, she definitely, always the last time I met her, she said, you, whatever you do, make sure that you study a bit of that in your country too, because representation is important, because then you understand so much more rich information.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah,
that's very, very good to know, and maybe something that people will need to think about, including me, definitely. You probably have seen how I'm trying to get out of the idea of PhD, but
we'll see.
I mean, I know that probably at some point I'll feel left out, because I'm telling you, Anjana, so many of my friends are either, and they are, close to my age now, either have started or are starting. So I think even some of the people that I brought on the podcast, my friend Hassan from the first episode, he's about to start on his PhD. Someone else I'm talking to come on the podcast also started her PhD. So I mean, it's probably will be good peer pressure at the end and get me there.
That's interesting. I think you would do well as it is, even without peer pressure in the PhD program. But, I think you would be really valuable. I'm actually curious as to why, what's keeping you so much away from a PhD. Is it Is it like the commitment?
Yeah, I do have commitment issues.
With the PhD.
With the PhD, of course. But it's also, I mean, it is more, you know, yeah, I think it's mainly the commitment. I don't know if I, at this time, will want to do something for, you know, 3 years or 5 years. I am very interested in the research, and I am very curious about a lot of things. But it's also like will need to be something that I see the benefit of. I mean, definitely just doing a PhD on its own is beneficial, but is it enough for me to, you know, get the benefits from doing it while I'm probably sacrificing other things? You know, the first thing is time, which is also, you know, depending on how people think about a PhD and what are their goals in it. Like a lot of the people, you know, want to do it because they are interested in a PhD, because they are academically oriented, because they are interested in a certain topic. Some people are just, you know, have other reasons in doing a PhD. So, we'll see.
I mean, I do think it's a huge commitment. I feel like you, once you join, you realize that there's so much to do in good science that it can take up 5 years to finally learn how to do good science.
Yeah.
You know, and it is intense. But I think the another thing that like strikes me is the money. Yeah. I think once we start making money,
yeah,
a PhD is a huge like fall. It's like, oh my God, like I can't do those things that I used to do so easily. And that is a huge, 5 years of that is huge.
Yeah.
I do have to accept that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So how about we talk a little bit about your journey, actually, from India to Dubai and then to here to the US, and how has it been so far? I mean, what got you to move from India in the first, and where in India are you from?
I'm from a city that we call Chennai. Mm-hmm. It used to be called Madras, but then we changed it. It is in South India. It's a beautiful place, has beautiful temples, and yeah, that's where I'm from.
Mm-hmm. And how and when did you move? What made you move from there?
So I moved because my ex-husband had his dream job offer from Emirates Airlines. Yeah, mm-hmm. The first day I met him, I think it was the first day I met him, he said one day I'd like to fly Emirates. So that was his dream, and so we decided when he got the offer, we decided to take it on. And that's why we moved to Dubai.
Mm-hmm. So and was he also an engineer?
Oh, good question. No, he's a pilot.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So he, you know, I don't know if you've seen the movie Avatar.
What's his name? James Cameron's Avatar?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a big, big red bird that, you know, that he kind of boards after riding a smaller bird. And that once he rides the big red bird, they call him Toruk Makto. So, you know, I used to be like, oh, Toruk Makto, you know, because he was flying his dream airline. So we followed his dream to Dubai. So that's what brought me there. It was a very interesting thing because before I was married, I had decided I'll stay in India for the rest of my life. So when my father told me, it was an arranged marriage, and when my father told me, oh, this person wants to one day work in the Middle East, I was like, no. I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. Tell him no. But so completely unexpectedly, I found myself in Dubai. So interesting, a very interesting move, actually.
That's awesome. And so what year was that
when you moved to Dubai? 2013,
okay.
Yeah.
And then how was moving to Dubai? How did you feel there the first thing? I mean, definitely traveling into a new country and starting a new life is not easy.
Oh, it was exciting. And yeah, not easy, but very exciting because like you said, I'd never been out of my country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, traveling maybe, but never really lived elsewhere. And then all of a sudden here I was with a 2-year-old. It was a big change and, but it was an exciting change. Dubai is so different from where I grew. You know, I was astounded that there was sand everywhere, but there were also lawns and fountains. It's such a futuristic looking city.
Yeah.
It's the way you thought the West looked in the movies. And then you come to this place and it's got this, you know, it's got this vibe of being rustic. It also has this vibe of being futuristic. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it coming together. So it was very interesting. I thought the whole experience of moving in was interesting. I did remember, and I think we've spoken about this before, getting lost in Dubai Mall. Like, oh, wow. My first visit here, I had a map, but I was lost in Dubai Mall.
I know.
So, yeah.
And then, so when you were personally lost, you didn't forget where you parked your car and you couldn't find it.
Oh, no. I was just lost inside the mall. I was like, where was this place again? It was so huge.
Yeah.
I have still not seen a mall that is as beautiful and big as Dubai Mall. And even today, I remember walking around Safa Park and looking at the Burj Khalifa and thinking, what? Like, how? You know, it is just absolutely stunning. But I do remember being completely lost in Dubai Mall. And I also remember the first time I walked outdoors. So I fully underestimated what Dubai summer weather could do to me. So I got off my cab early and I thought, oh, there's that building. I just walked to it. 5 minutes, fully dehydrated, completely unhappy. but you know, you learn and you kind of live a new kind of life altogether. And I think that's very interesting. So in India, for example, when there were monsoons, we'd walk in water that's up to your knees. And that's okay. If it goes any further, the schools will be off. Until then, the schools will still be on.
How long would the monsoon season go for?
You know, that's a good question. Again, I don't remember. I think long enough. But I think I shouldn't trivialize it, but as a child growing up, it was completely trivial to me. So monsoons just meant there'll be these days where you'll send boats in the water and, you know, you trudge to school and hope that there's no holes in the ground. You know, so that was an experience, but then there's this completely different experience of it's a sandstorm day today and you're picking your kid from school.
I remember that.
You know, so it's just... it's just very different experiences. And now I feel that with the snow. And so it's like, snow day, don't slip.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Because
it's just different.
Because in Chicago, I've been to Chicago only once. I actually was there during the New Year's. Oh, and that's when I told you, I said, hey, I'm in Chicago, let's meet up. And then you said, actually, I'm in California. I came to visit. Remember that.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
But Chicago is crazy with the snow and cold. It's probably like it's not the I don't think it's the most snowy state in the U.S. but it's the coldest. I don't know how.
I think it's they say it's the wind chills. They say that the wind brings, you know, even more cold air and it's kind of piercy. But I also think Chicago is winters are one of the most beautiful things on the planet. People don't always agree with me. But the first time it snowed, I honestly walked on the road like it was only snowing on me. It felt so dreamy. I still look at it and think, how can things be so beautiful and so bigger than us? These things are bigger than us. A sandstorm, much bigger than you. Monsoon, it makes you realize how small and insignificant you are. But as humans, we think we're the center of the world.
That's very true. There are all these experiences. I mean, I definitely had that thought when I was at the Grand Canyon in Arizona, which is, if you haven't been, you have to go, and then you're just standing there in front of all this, you know, might. Like, it's the biggest thing in my life. It's not the biggest mountain that I saw, so definitely it is bigger, but when you're standing there and just looking at how large it is and how small you are as a human... like you'll have chills going through your body. You're thinking, "Oh my God, I'm so small. I'm smaller than so many things."
Yeah, totally feel you.
Yeah.
So, have you traveled a lot within the U.S.? Is there a favorite place for you to go?
In the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I definitely liked. I've done a couple of the main cities and states. So Washington. I came to Chicago. Traveled in South California and California. I went to Texas, Washington, the capital, Washington, D.C., and Washington, the states. I think one of my most favorite is New Orleans. It is I don't know if you've noticed that in the States, like although it is really large and big, so it's not like just to go from East Coast to West Coast, you have to get on a 5 hours plane, which is, you know, a whole continent. But you feel like there is some similarity, a lot of similarity between the states, even when there is a lot of differences. But New Orleans and you know, when you go to the South, and New Orleans is a completely different story. I went there on a trip with my friend, and it was amazing. I mean, it's known for the Mardi Gras, which is part of the bigger carnival that happens, and it's the carnival that happens in Brazil, and then it goes and, you know, it's sort of a, I think originally it was a Christian carnival that changed now to be something that is not too Christian, but it's really nice in New Orleans when it happens, like a lot of music, a lot of floats, dances, and New Orleans is known for jazz, so there's a lot of really good jazz there. The New Orleans and sort of the southern cuisine itself is amazing. Like, we've had some really, really some of the best dishes in the US there. That's where I tried alligator for the first time. Are you're vegetarian, or I can't remember?
I've been all over the place. Right now, I eat anything that can move or not move. but there was a time in which I was a vegan. Yeah. There was a time when I was vegetarian. I've tried different things. I think I've always had a conflict between my values. And one of my values is kindness to animals. Another value is experimentation and openness. So they're almost always conflicting when it comes to food. Yeah. But do you know which is my favorite place in the United States? You will not believe what I'm going to tell you.
The Bay Area.
New Orleans.
New Orleans? Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was fully prepared to tell you that. And then you were like,
I didn't know that.
I was like, yeah, you're saying all the right things. Yes.
It is so beautiful.
It is stunning. It is so laid back and so full of culture and so full of filling your senses in every possible way. And the hospitality there is beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We went there to one of the best museums also in the world for the World War, for the Second World War. It's huge. It's like, you know, one of these things that you have to spend a day or two to see everything. And it's told from, like, you know, museums are one of the tools that that country would show something rather than other things. So when you go through the museum, you would say, oh yeah, that's very American. It's told from an American point of view, but it's amazing. There's the history that's in there. It's designed into pavilions, and each pavilion is one region of the world during the World War II. So one of them is like, here's the Japan, here's what's been happening in Japan. And you would go through the whole history, you know, different exhibits from the history. It was really beautiful. Then you go somewhere else and here's, you know, what was happening in Germany. And here's, we didn't have time to finish it all. It was really, really good. But again, you know, all the people that you meet in the museum and outside in the, really the hospitality and you can tell, you know, some really nice family values, some really nice welcoming, but also at times you could tell, I can see, you know, some not very welcoming people, and you can see it there more because it's a place where a lot of visitors would come from other states, and some of these other states, you know, are more, these are more probably the Bible Belt states or something like that. So you end up having, you know, people from all different type of thinking, I think. And we did have two times when, like, I don't know if you had this problem, but especially during the last 4 years, there were times when we wouldn't speak Arabic, like in public, before the 2000, and during some problems that happened on planes, they were just, you know, there was it was really nasty. And so when we were there, it was happening again. Like, when we would speak Arabic in public, there would be some people would look at you and turn and you know, gazing at you? Why are you not speaking English or something like that? Because, which is something that does happen here. So, and you face as, I don't know if you've had something like it, but as an immigrant to the United States, this is something that you do face.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is actually something I've always been very blind to. Unfortunately, like in Dubai, people would tell me, oh, there's like prejudice here. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? Not at all. And then I came here and they were like, there's prejudice here. And I'm like, ah, but I study it. And so I know that it's there. I've just been very lucky in my life because I've actually never felt that I was prejudiced against in any way. People I've met have always like been super enabling and super, you know, like just recently I met with my neighbors and they're evangelical Christians. And I studied in an Islamic college and I think I was a shock to them. And I studied my engineering in an Islamic college. I forgot to tell you. So I was a shock to them and they were a shock to me. But I think we talked and it was great. Having said that, I think a lot of people can undermine the experiences of others based on the fact that they didn't experience something.
True.
And the truth is, there is prejudice in this world, and it is not right to have prejudice in this world. Is it something that our mind sometimes tricks us into? Yes. But can we work on our minds? Yes, it's our responsibility to. And I find that I'm privileged like that, and I also know that a lot of people are not. And it's a harder climb, and it shouldn't be a harder climb. We all should have the same climb. It's a harder climb for some people. But also, I think it's very scary to be in a place and not feel very welcomed. I had that fear coming in with my son, actually, because I was like, oh, my God, like, I'm hearing so many things about the U.S. Little brown kid. Is he going to be okay? He's been very welcome. But again, you kind of do know. You kind of hear the stories. You kind of see, you know, what's happening. And it's not very pleasant sometimes. But, yeah, I've been lucky. Nothing here. But I'm sorry about that. You were enjoying New Orleans, and then you had to go through this too? Oh.
I mean, it's one of these things, you know, you especially here coming to the U.S., you have to live with and you know that you'll face at some point. There were a couple of times that happened for me here more than once. I don't know if it's, you know, for men it's more difficult or if it's at least, you know, for Muslim women it's even more because especially if Muslim women's wearing the hijab, there could be more of these things that happen. But definitely, it's even, I think it's even more documented and researched, and there's a lot of research about how strong it is. I know there's been a lot of progress around it, and especially, I think now with the media and with the internet and with how people are coming closer and the travel and the increase in travel. So it has been changing a lot, and maybe that is one of the solutions to it. The more we know other people, the more you have friends who are not like you and from other, but it's not easy for everyone.
Yeah, so I think it's so important. I can't agree with you more that we need more exposure to each other and to other people. One of the things I've been luckiest about is that sort of exposure. You know, back in India, you can be of any, at least around the time I grew up there, my best friend was Muslim. During Ramadan, she would fast all day. I would be sitting right next to her eating. She would fast all day. She wouldn't drink a drop of water. And then in the evening, when they break fast, they would invite me. So I'd have had food all day and then I'd go have biryani with them. So, you know, I studied in a convent before I moved to an Islamic college for a while. So I've studied in a convent, a Hindu school and an Islamic college. I've gone to church. Mm-hmm. I've been at a touristy mosque. And I've been to temples. And I think moving to Dubai, for example, I didn't know the point of Ramadan until I moved to Dubai and someone said, this is actually so we can feel the pain of people who don't have the things we do. Mm-hmm. And in the evening, it's about sharing that. And I had no clue about it. And I think when you go into a culture, you point one, learn that actually their religion actually kind of has some really beautiful values if you can just try to understand it and not be terrified by it. And when I come here, I feel very similar about Thanksgiving. I'm like, it's such a beautiful idea. And I think people need to get to know each other. People need to celebrate each other's festivities, celebrate together. And without that, you're going to always be afraid of who you don't know. And I think that has to change. We do need to make friends of different kinds.
Totally
agree. And we do need to be open to that sort of thing, experience.
Totally agree. And I think that's something that both Dubai and the United States provide to people, because being, you know, sort of a place where a lot of people come from different nationalities and they gather together, they know each other. So I probably, if I stayed in Iraq, and Iraq is very isolated during the years that I grew up in, so it was war after war after war. We didn't have a lot of, like, we've had immigrants or tourists come to the country, but it wasn't as prevalent as what you see like here or in Dubai. So definitely, I do feel lucky that I've lived in these two places and have met a lot of, you know, friends like you, friends from all walks of life. So I do, again, you know, like you, feel privileged at times that I've had that and can talk about it very freely. Yeah. While other people probably still trying to understand what it means and why is it bad, and at times having all these different people from different countries and different regions come together, it might has negative impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you come to a place that's a bit of a hub like Dubai or in the United States, the advantage is that you get exposure. The disadvantage is that that's also the place where you can show bias and you can show prejudice, you know, if you're not open enough or if you haven't had the right exposure.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of research going on. I do think there's progress, but is there enough progress? I don't know for sure about it. I think we can call it progress when we can all feel safe and happy and comfortable wherever we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we as a, you know, species are a long way from doing that. Like, we are speaking at a time when there is a war happening in another side of the world. Despite our so many lessons we must have learned by now, that war is not good. So it is beyond me why we do what we do sometimes, which is why we should study it.
I knew it was going to go back to that. So I should do my PhD.
Yeah.
All right.
Totally.
How long, I know I've, we've said that probably this will go to an hour, but I still have so many questions that I just want to be respectful of your time. So I don't know if, do you think it's, you will have another, you still have time, or do you have other responsibilities?
I can speak for like 10, 15 more minutes, maybe. I have friends coming over for dinner, but if they come in and join the podcast, you can just say hi.
All right. So probably let's end with two things, and then definitely there's a lot of things that I still would like to talk to you about maybe on another episode. But if you want to give two pieces of advice to the viewers and listeners, you know, being you and knowing you and thinking of, you know, as Anjana, on what are the two most important things that you would like our viewers or listeners to work on, what would they be?
Okay, so I think off the top of my head, the two things that I would like to share today, there are lots of lessons for all of us to learn, but this is a lesson I'm trying to learn for myself, is to learn to be soft and mm-hmm. to learn to be firm. And what I mean by that is that, at least from where the culture I come from, and a lot of our cultures, there is this need to be like yes to everyone, to please everyone, to give them what they want, and to just compromise. And I think what I'm learning from my experience in the United States in particular is it's okay to say no,
mm-hmm.
provided you're not saying no just to say no. You're saying no because you're looking at your situation and this is something you can't do. And it's okay to kind of be assertive. It's okay to ask for what you want. These are things you can be firm about. And you don't need to be too soft and flexible about. But at the same time, I think it's like super important to, you know, have that softness in you in life. Things might be difficult. Things might throw you down and throw you around. But don't forget that softness of affection for people, trust in others, you know. So I think the one thing that I've been thinking about this year is to kind of learn how to be soft and firm at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have, so that's really great. First, be more soft and then also be more firm and assertive. Do you have like any practical advice on how you've personally did that? So thinking about it, or are there any certain ways that you've seen you've improved in these two areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think being soft is something I haven't had issues with. I am a very trusting person. Sometimes it's just something I need to remind myself. If I ever find myself getting a bit, you know, pressured during tough times, I might be like, oh, this is so hard. And then I'll be like, it's okay. Just find that joy inside you. It's somewhere there. And it's easier to find, though. But I think being firm has been a huge struggle for me. I don't like saying no to anyone. Mm-hmm. And that means I either keep doing until I explode and can't do anything anymore. So I think the one thing I've learned is to kind of wait when someone asks you something, to either pause before you respond or to say, can I think about this? And then respond after a day. Because between can I think about this and then responding, you're doing two things. One is you're giving yourself time to say no if it's difficult for you to say no. Off the beat. And the second thing is you're letting the other person also know, you know, this is not just nothing to me. This is time. This is, you know, something for me. So let me think about it. So when you actually do it, the other person appreciates that, wow, like this person actually chose to do this for me. So so I worked with my counselor on this, to be very honest, but we're trying to figure out how it is that I can say yes with joy. Mm-hmm. In a way that adds value to both parties, and then say no without hurting. And to kind of convey that no doesn't mean no to you, it just means no for me. Yeah. And I think it's doable. We just need to pause between when we should respond and when we do respond to start with.
That's a great advice, Anjana. I think probably like I can see how it will work, just, you know, having that time when you're saying you don't say immediately yes. I mean, I don't think I've had problem a lot with saying no. I would say probably the other way.
Yeah? Oh, that's interesting. I'm going to try. Once you've forgotten this conversation, I'm going to ask you something and see what happens.
I do. I can say no, but I probably say it sometimes. I feel like I say it more than I need to. But definitely, I've really appreciated how at least you've put your time. So that has been really helpful for the podcast. I was going to say, are you familiar with improv theater?
Yes.
Have you done any exercises or have you done improv?
No, my son does it.
Okay, that's great. So you know, he has probably the most famous thing about improv theater is the yes and. So the yes and is, but don't yes use and. It. Uh-huh. But that's not for you. I'm just sharing with you.
Not for me. For me, it's maybe. That's,
maybe.
Later.
Yeah. And I did improv theater for about a year where I've done classes. And one of the main concepts of it is saying yes to everything. And when I was doing that, while I didn't do it because I wanted to say yes more, I was just doing it because I enjoyed it, but I did see that it was changing my way of doing yes to things. Or so, you know, it does get embedded in you and it changes your behavior. And I've sometimes said yes to things that got me in either a situation that I didn't want to. I don't know if you can still see me.
I can.
Or hear me. It says, for some reason, it says the camera is disabled.
Huh. I can see you and hear you.
Okay, great. So I'll just continue and it's, you know, if I don't know if it will be recorded or not, but this is again one of the challenges that we had with the podcast being done.
We can always online. Work on it.
Yeah. So it does change me, like it did change me to say yes more to things. And I can see how thinking more about saying no will be useful for some people. So if they try to maybe say no and to things, then they will get into the habit of changing that a lot. So really good advice, I think, for the people who are listening or seeing us.
I think yes and no are such strong and powerful words by the looks of it. Some things for us to think of more, I think. Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. All right, so Thank you so much. I still can't see, and I think it might be my internet, but it's a good point that we end maybe the podcast here.
Yeah, I can still see you and hear you, and I can tell you that it was amazing fun talking today, as always.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed also catching up with you and Jen, and really made use of our conversation. I think there's a lot of really good lessons. And I still have a lot on my list that I haven't discussed with you. So maybe we can at some point again in the future, you can come back to the podcast and have another one.
Love it. That will be fun.
Okay, that's great.
Well, I wish you a really... Let me know what you do. I want to know. I want to watch all your podcasts. Maybe you can translate them for me.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm going to start probably... This is the first one that's going to be translated. So from English to Arabic for people to read, at least on YouTube. But definitely for the other ones, I am, depending on how much interest there is in an Arabic podcast that goes to English, then probably I'll even translate those. But, oh, here you are. You're back. Definitely for at least the shorter term, we'll let you know how it goes and try to give you a quick summary of what every podcast is about.
That sounds great. Awesome.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Anjana. I wish you a great rest of your evening.
Absolutely. You too. Enjoy the sun.
Thank you so much.
Coming our way.
It's really, right. Really fun here. Okay. Bye.
Bye.